This is Victoria, producer for The Felon File, a podcast on law enforcement history, issues, and incidents in the Appalachian Mountains of the United States and beyond. Listen to in 39 countries around the world. Scott Lunsford hosts The Felon File. Scott is a retired American police sergeant. Background and intro music through purpleplanet.com.
Thanks, Victoria, and welcome back, folks, to another episode of The Felon File, where we look at what we refer to as Shade of Blue stories about crime and punishment in the Appalachian Mountains, Western North Carolina, the United States, and beyond there. And today, we're going beyond. My wife and I recently had a dinner with some friends the other night. As happens often, the talk turned to murder, or at least tales of murder. This is usually noticeable by the look of the faces of the other diners, which may be within earshot and listening to the conversations. Now, Victoria had taken up a position that the United States did not have the lock on serial killers. Europe and other countries had been run full with serial killers before the United States was a country, or even the discovery of North America. My wife of Cherokee ancestry pointed out that, of course, North America did not need to be discovered, and the local indigenous population had known about it for years. That turned the conversation to some old Cherokee stories. But it wasn't long before the talk returned back to serial killers. And this time, the specific serial killers on each side of the Atlantic. It was then I realized the discussion had turned to what side of the ocean had the most dangerous whack jobs, or basically the worst serial killers. This realization and the looks on the faces of individuals a bit uncomfortable with our discussion, not to mention the waiter who seemed to want us to kind of move along, it was a good idea to pay the check and find a location that would be more comfortable for us and anyone else who might be listening. The results turned into a Shade of Blue story, or at least a couple of them, at least three that Victoria picked out from the other side of the pond. Well, that's what they call the ocean over there, isn't it, Victoria?
Just to let you know, Scott, you're not being funny.
Okay, all right. I'm sorry. Anyway, Victoria's United Kingdom serial killers are the topic for your Shade of Blue story for today, and probably our next podcast as well. So sit back and listen to Victoria's United Kingdom serial killers and bad people. Our first subject on Victoria's list was born in Glasgow, Scotland in 1938. Ian Brady was his name. He was described as a troubled child with some issues while growing up. His youth was spent in the slums of Glasgow. He did time locked up as a teenager for breaking and entering and some other minor crimes. Ian had been born to a single mother, Peggy Stewart, January 2nd, 1938. He never knew who his father was. Because of mom's work schedule and low pay, a babysitter or a daycare situation was kind of out of the question. Mom had to leave Ian alone many times when she was working at her job as a waitress. Having to leave him alone, she realized wasn't good for him, so she put him up for adoption at about the age of 4, but not in a legal way. It was kind of an under-the-counter adoption, so to speak. She continued to keep contact with him until he was about 12, but never told him that she was actually his mother. Brady was a lonely kid growing up, despite his adoptive parents attempting to help him as best as they could. He was quick to have temper tantrums and slow to make friends, which made it difficult for him to fit in. He developed a fascination as he was growing up with the Nazis and the writing of Nietzsche. Excellent role models, I guess, if you're looking to go a little crazy. He started doing and getting involved with simple crimes, breaking and entering the local homes in the neighborhood, things that he felt comfortable with. This activity finally forced him to return at 16 to live with his real mother and stepfather, Patrick Brady, to avoid having to do actual prison time. Ian took his stepdad's last name. He did try to fit in with his new family, even, like I said, taking his stepdad's last name. His reading interests continued to be on the extreme side. An interest in the Third Reich and not only Nietzsche, but the Marquis de Sade and other sadistic authors that were out there. His interest, like these books, took him in the direction of illegal activities. And of course, eventually this ended up landing him at 17-year-old in court and then at Strange Way Prisons. Victoria, why is it called Strange Ways Prison? That's a cool name for a prison, really.
This is the men's prison. It was built in Manchester, England, in 1869. His Majesty's Prison Service operates it. It is still commonly referred to as Strange Ways Prison. Its former official name. The name is derived from the area in which it is located, the community of Strange Ways. It was renamed after being rebuilt following a major riot in 1990.
Oh, neat. Thanks, Victoria. Finding himself at 17 in an adult prison situation, Brady kind of had to man up, so to speak. While in prison, he did actually learn some basic bookkeeping skills and was released in 1957. Finding himself even more of a loner, he did different manual labor jobs on and off until he picked up employment as a stock clerk with a Manchester, England firm. A benefit of the stock clerk job was that he ended up meeting Miss Mariah Hindley when she started to work there as a secretary in 1961. Now, Hindley was intrigued by Brady. Seeing romance and intelligence in his aloofness, Hindley recorded her thoughts on Brady in her diary. Documenting her thoughts and feelings for over a year before he finally started showing interest in her. And then the two started dating. Brady began sharing his extreme political views and taking her to see the film The Nuremberg Trials on their first date, and encouraging her to read his copies of Hitler and De Sade and other extreme writings. Brady was her first love, and it didn't take long before she was literally under his spell, concentrating on keeping him happy by catering to his needs and wishes, dressing only to please him, and accepting his extreme political views, and even letting him talk her into posing for pornographic photos for him. Her infatuation and willingness to follow him and his ideas fed into Brady's ego. Encouraged by her unquestioning acceptance, Brady's ideas became more outrageous and extreme, with the idea that murder and rape were the good things and were part of supreme pleasure, what he referred to it as. The young lady's family and friends took notice of Brady's influence and the effect he had on her, becoming more secretive and argumentative. Brady pretended to plan a robbery at one point to see how she would react. He was more than happy that she followed all his orders to a T without question. Brady had found his soulmate, the one person who would assist him in making his strange and dangerous ideas of pain, perversion, and pleasure a reality. On the night of July 12, 1963, 16-year-old Pauline Reed became their first victim. Henley kidnapped her as she was on the way to a local dance. Taking the 16-year-old victim to a pre-arranged location where Brady waited for her. Reed was raped, beaten, stabbed, and murdered. After she died, she was buried close by. 4 months later, November 23, 1963, 12-year-old John Kilbride disappeared from a local store. He was never seen alive again. This was the beginning of what the news media started calling the Moore's Murders. On June 16, 64, 12-year-old Kenneth Bennett disappeared while walking to his grandmother's house, and it wasn't determined that he was missing until the next day, when the family went by grandma's and found out that he had never showed up. A massive police search was put together, and nothing was located that could point officers in the direction of the investigation. What Henley did was lure the 12-year-old into her car, having stopped when seeing him walking along the street. She conned him into the vehicle by convincing him she needed help loading up some boxes into her car. The young man was going to help somebody out. And this is the thanks he got. Meeting with Brady on Saddleworth Moor, the young man was taken to a washed out area next to a stream, sexually assaulted, raped, strangled, and then buried there. On the afternoon of Boxing Day, 1964, and if you weren't aware of it, Victoria told me Boxing Day is a holiday celebrated right after Christmas Day. 10-year-old Leslie Ann Downey went missing from a fairground. Another massive police search was put together, this involving citizen help. But once more, no evidence was located, and Leslie was not found. The breakthrough in the Moore murders occurred in October of 1965 in the missing person case of Maria Henley's 17-year-old brother-in-law. Brother-in-law David Smith had turned up at the Hyde police station with a strange story. Having known Brady through the family connection, Smith had been taken aback by his sister-in-law's boyfriend's bizarre and weird political ideas, philosophy, and violent politics. That day, before he had went to the police station, he had gone by Henley and Brady's home on the evening of October 6. He saw Brady killing 17-year-old Edward Evans with an axe. Henley and Brady joked about the mess after Evans was strangled with a power cord. Apparently, this activity opened up the conversation. The two told Smith of other victims buried in the moors. Concealing his horror for fear of meeting a similar fate, Smith assisted them with the cleanup before returning home to tell his wife and also the police. Convinced by Smith's story, police backup arrived at Brady's home, found the body of Evans in an upstairs bedroom, and arrested Brady on the spot. Brady claimed that there had been an argument between himself, Evans, and Smith that had gotten out of hand, denying that Henley had anything to do with the murder. She remained at liberty until 4 days later, when police found a document in her car describing how she and Brady planned to carry out the murder. Good documentation sometimes can be the downfall of an individual, or the bringing up. The investigation would probably have gone no further than the death of Evans If brother-in-law Smith had not told the investigator of Brady's claim that other bodies were buried on Saddleworth Moor. Already working on several unexplained disappearances and missing person cases, investigators were able to locate an area that was favored by Brady and Henley, and there they started digging, looking for possible bodies who had been missing for the last 2 years. They found the naked body of Leslie Ann Downey in October of 1965. 11 days later, the body of John Kilbride. Even though they had located two bodies, the police really only had circumstantial evidence that the two were involved with them. Another search of their home led to discovering a storage locker ticket and checking out the locker at the Manchester Central Station. Police found the collection of sadistic toys and devices, as well as a collection of pornography, including bondage photographs of Leslie Ann. A tape recording was also found on which the little girl could be heard crying and begging for her life, as well as the voices of Brady and Henley. Her mother, Ann Downey, was forced to identify her daughter's voice on the tape while listening to it. Even with the mounting evidence against them, Brady and Henley denied murdering Leslie Ann. Trying again to implicate brother-in-law David Smith, they claimed that Leslie Ann had left their home unharmed and that Smith must have murdered her later. The evidence linking the two with John Kilby's murder was not as strong. The investigation turned up enough of the evidence to bring murder charges on the two for the killing of Edward Evans, Leslie Downey, and John Kilbride. Searches of the area the two were connected to did not turn up the other two victims. Thus, no other charges were filed on the two of the missing person cases. Henley and Brady were placed on trial in April of 1966. They pled not guilty to all charges. This increased the media circus around the investigation and the trial. The press focused on the lack of public remorse shown by the two killers. And on May 6, 1966, Brady was found guilty of the murder of Leslie Ann Downey, John Kilbride, and Edward Evans. Hendel was found guilty of the murders of Leslie Downey and Edward Evans and harboring Brady in the knowledge that he had killed John Kilbride. The two were given life sentences. Ian Brady returned to the limelight once more when he went on a hunger strike that next October while locked up at England's Ashworth Psychiatric Hospital, demanding that he had the legal right to starve himself to death. Do this rather than serve his life in prison. Basically a self-styled execution, I guess. But Brady was kept secured and medically fed for a while. The English High Court in 2000 upheld the hospital's right to force feed him. Deciding not to try to execute himself, instead, Brady wrote a book, The Gates of Janus, and made some royalties off of the title. In August of 2021, Brady was front page news once again when it was revealed that he stood to earn £12,000 for the book he had written about serial killers, though it made no mention of his crimes or put any new light on his activities. The book's publication, of course, was condemned by the families of the murdered people. Brady also wrote an autobiography, which actually ends up and still is being held by his lawyers, pending publication after his death. And the two books, you can check them out. They're online and Amazon. Although, I wouldn't buy an original copy. I would look for a used copy. So you don't contribute to the coffers of a killer. In February 2006, Brady sent the mother of victim Keith Bennett a letter. In the letter, he complained of his treatment at the high security hospital, saying he was imprisoned by force feeding for political purposes. Brady also claimed he could take police within 20 yards of where Keith Bennett is buried. It's thought that Brady was able to send the letter out by a third party. In 2017, Brady was the longest serving prisoner in England and Wales. Ian Brady died on March 15, 2017. His official cause of death was COPD, or an enlargement of the right side of his heart due to the disease of the lungs or the pulmonary blood vessels. Brady's former lawyer, Benedict Brinberg, the executioner of his estate, told the BBC News that Brady himself did not receive money from the books he wrote. The advance of $5,000 plus all the royalties would be used to help support his mother, who was then in her 90s. Maria, at the age of 60, died from respiratory failure after suffering from a series of heart and lung conditions that had caused her health to deteriorate in the weeks before her death. She was a chain smoker who smoked up to 40 cigarettes a day. She experienced various health problems and issues while she was in prison. She reportedly took 42 separate medications daily for her many ailments at her death. In 1999, she was hospitalized suffering from a brain aneurysm. Despite a continued effort to make parole and release from prison, Myra was still locked up at her death. She had been moved from her cell at High Point Prison near Havenhill for tests at the Suffolk Hospital but ended up taking a turn for the worse. In 1970, Henley had broken off all contact with Brady. In 1987, she released a full confession to the media about her involvement in the murders, and she applied for parole many times but was denied each and every one. Maria had returned to Catholicism while in prison, and on the day of her death, she was read the last rites by a prison priest before being reread them for the last time that afternoon. According to the priest who accompanied Henley on her deathbed, the murderer's last words were all about concern for her mother. Well, that's our Shade of Blue stories on some of Victoria's United Kingdom killers and serial killers. Be sure to come back for our next episode, where we're going to look at another collection of United Kingdom serial killers that Victoria has brought to my attention and helped me research. Fred and Rosemary West, also from the United Kingdom and England. So be sure to come back for that particular Shade of Blue story. I have another couple of a very unusual and odd nature. In the meantime, remember, be safe and be responsible. If you have the opportunity, help somebody out. Do the right thing. If we all stop to help somebody out when they needed it, and really turn the world into a better place. And if more people are doing good things, hopefully there's less and fewer people doing bad things. I'll kind of keep that in mind. If you want more information, you can check out our website, felonfile.com, or scottlunsfordauthor.com, where you can find copies of the books and links to the podcast, as well as links to drop us a line if you have comments or opinions you'd like to let us know or want to share some information with us. We'd love to hear from you. Or you can email us direct at felonfile at @gmail.com. So, Victoria, I guess that's it. I'm going to close it out. You've got the control board back to you in your hands. We'll talk to you all later. Be sure to check us out. Bye, y'all.
Ian Brady, Myra Hindley, The English Moor Murders. In the shadows of a lonely past, a man emerged, with evil cast. Ian Brady, his name whispered, feared, born in 38, a path appeared. Raised by a single mother's plea, from tender years, he longed to be free. A haunting abyss consumed his soul, a lonely kid, seeking control. Intrigued by the sinister Nazi regime, and Hitler's power, a distorted dream. Through Nietzsche's words, darkness grew, Marquis de Sade's tales, twisted and true. Strange ways prison, his fate entwined, within those walls, a malevolent mind. In 61, he met Myra Hindley's gaze, convincing her to join his wicked ways. Brady's ideas, more outrageous than before, believing murder and rape brought supreme pleasure's allure. Evil acts, assaults, and murder, his twisted notion, a sickening bliss, with no remorse or emotion. 16-year-old Pauline Reed, their first prey, a victim to darkness, taken away. But it didn't end there. Oh, the horrors they wrought, 12 lives taken, their souls forever caught. With conviction, life in jail they would bear, locked away, for the world to beware. Yet in the confines of their prison cells, they nurtured their darkness, where evil dwells. Both died behind bars, headed for that special hell, their legacy of terror, society can never quell. May the souls of the lost find solace in light, while these monsters remain locked in eternal night. This has been The Felon File, a discussion on law enforcement, history, issues, and incidents in the Appalachian Mountains and other parts of the world. For more information, you can go to felonfile.com or scottlunsfordauthor.com. Here you can find links to Scott and Num books and other information. You can also email us at felonfile@gmail.com. There are also t-shirts and mugs available. You can also buy us a cup of coffee, or help purchase some of the research material and expenses it takes to do Felon File. Click on the coffee image on the web page to do so. This is Victoria, your producer. Thank you for listening. Have a good one.